This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Timps.
I'm Danny Hogan.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week, we're talking about abuse in relationships with Izzy Staden. And the very first thing we wanted to mention, or particularly Danielle wanted to mention, is when we talk about relationships, we don't just specifically mean romantic relationships, although that is the content of today's interview, because this is something that's often overlooked, that abuse of this nature can exist in all kinds of households. It doesn't necessarily mean you have to be in a romantic relationship.
It's really important also to state that, like with most things in life, our experiences differ. So you're right, Bobby, to stipulate abuse and relationships as such open and broad topics, and what they mean to one and what they mean to another are really subjective.
It's a complicated one even to describe sometimes, because there's so many nuances, but then there are also parts that are very clear. Like sometimes the variation to which abuse can exist in is used as a rationale to explain away cases of rape and consent. But in reality, it is possible for consent to be black and white.
Yes.
Whilst abuse and kind of behaviours more broadly can have more of a sliding scale. We've also got a definition here from the National Helpline, an organisation that supports women, particularly those in crisis trying to leave abusive situations, through refuge services, through counselling, and of course their 24-hour helpline. They define abuse within their context as domestic abuse is a pattern of behaviour on the part of the abuser designed to control his partner. It can happen at any point in a relationship, including after you have split up. This is an interesting definition. Obviously, it gives an idea of what we're talking about today, but we also wanted to highlight it because of how it's gendered.
Mm-hmm.
So this is an organisation specifically to support women. Maybe that's part of what informs the language they use, where they say designed to control his partner. The other side of that is you could say, well, is this excluding male victims? And indeed, it's something that I've come across through work I've done, particularly with the Samaritans. So when I joined the Samaritans in my local branch here in Birmingham, we had a whole book of resources of where to signpost people. So that's a key part of being a Samaritan. It's not just the service you give over the phone or the emails or the text. It's also the way you can signpost to other support as well is really important, and important that we do that appropriately, in a way that's not pushy, in a way that's caller-led, etc. There's all this training around it. And as part of that, we have specific resources that have been pre-approved to recommend. And one of the most difficult calls I had was with a domestic abuse victim who happened to be male, and I was working a night shift. So I must have been on the phone with him for some time, and you know, this was like 2 a.m. And then when it came to it being relevant to offer signposting, I was already pre-prepping by looking through our book, and we didn't have any services for domestic abuse that were accessible to men.
Wow.
And so at the branch, that's one of the things I then ended up raising as a concern and finding an appropriate resource, which we've actually got some stats from today. It's just such an obvious oversight, an important one to raise, because as that definition shows, we still can far too easily fall into the idea of this being one way around just.
Absolutely.
And of course, then there's the complications of does that exclude trans people as well, who are very commonly victims of domestic abuse as well. So, for example, from the Scottish Transgender Alliance, they reported that 73% of respondents had experienced at least one type of domestic abuse from a partner or ex-partner.
Bloody hell. And it's like we were talking about this earlier, Bobby, weren't we, in terms of the stats, and that we can become a bit immune to them. 73% is such a huge number. You know, that's a really scary figure. And you're right, the definition that you read out before, it's a really narrow definition.
Yeah, and you're exactly right that oftentimes when we get too binary with gender, we can have a very limited view. The reason why I particularly wanted to read that stat is because like you say, it's just so shocking, because essentially it means that if you are trans, you can expect to have domestic abuse as part of your life. And that's what's so scary, how common it is that it's most likely something you would experience. But equally, as we've said, it can affect all people. And one of the stats we have is from Mankind, which was the organisation I raised for Use at the Samaritans. They report that 1 in 6 to 7 men suffer from domestic abuse in their lifetime.
Wow.
It's massive. And even I read a statistic like that and I didn't even know it was that high.
When they say domestic abuse, as we said at the top of the show, we're talking about abuse and relationships quite broadly. Does domestic abuse... To me, domestic abuse is family, like in the house. But is domestic abuse, you think, coined in this way to mean romantic, like partner to partner?
I think that's kind of what is often implied. But when we're looking at these stats, it is in that broader sense we described. So you're right, it means abuse related to the home, really, as opposed to what you would come across in a workplace as another example of a setting. So relationships are always a part of those statistics, but indeed it can include family members. It can include, you know, people you're cohabiting with, flatmates, people in uni halls, you know, particularly in the States, there's a lot of problems in terms of the kind of initiations people have into frat houses and that kind of potentially setting up cycles of abuse right from when somebody joins a household.
100%. And we said it at the beginning, it's all about the way you feel and your own personal experience and some of the cultural differences that are perceived, or the definition that we read at the beginning, and how that kind of their approach was gendered, I think is the danger, that where therein kind of lies the stigma then that's attached, because potentially people then in those groups think, well, it's okay, this is what we do in our culture, or as a man I shouldn't really be feeling like, how can, you know, my wife be abusing me? She's a woman, I'm a man, you know, all of those things that really play into that stigma. And I think, as you said, Bobby, rightly so, it's got to be led by the victim or the person's experience. And if you're feeling that something's not right for you and you're hurt in some way, emotionally or physically, then it should be reported, you know, or you go and find some help and some support, and it's investigated and taken seriously, absolutely.
And that leads on nicely to the next lot of statistics, actually, which we got via Women's Aid. And they actually preface this with something quite important. So there is no reliable prevalence data on domestic abuse, but the Crime Survey of England and Wales offers the best data available. According to this data, for the year ending March 2019, on average, the police in England and Wales receive over 100 calls relating to domestic abuse every hour. And further to that, for the previous year, so ending March 2018, only 18% of women specifically who had experienced partner abuse in the last 12 months reported the abuse to the police. Almost 1 in 3 women aged 16 to 59 will experience domestic abuse in their lifetime. And that last one's from the ONS.
Staggering.
So, yeah. So again, massive statistics, but also good the way they've broken it down, you know, giving us an idea, over 100 calls an hour. And that's just England and Wales.
I mean, when I read that for the first time, I just thought, wow, like how have they got the people, you know, to just man those calls? It really made me realise how stretched, you know, the police are and what they're having to go through and really take seriously, especially for the fact, Bobby, that the figures have risen this year during lockdown by half. They've gone up by half. Calls to domestic abuse helpline have jumped by half in 2020 during lockdown.
Yeah, and I think that was the national helpline, actually. That's the one we referenced first off. It's actually quite difficult to wrap your head around. And also, right up the top there, they highlighted something important, describing that there's no reliable prevalence data. So Women's Aid, a charity specialising partly in this area, they're an authority on this, and they're saying, we can't even get the data. The experts can't even find reliable data. And that gives you an idea of how tricky it is when things are so underreported, when ideas of what is and isn't abuse can be quite narrow, can often exclude certain kinds of incidents. And that's why I was really glad to get to speak to Izzy about this, because she's someone that's primarily known as a musician. She's also up and coming through social media, promoting her music, particularly on TikTok. She's a real rising star. And so her experience is quite closely linked to the Me Too movement. And you'll understand more what I mean by that as we get into that interview. So whilst we've talked about a broad range of abuse, actually her story is quite similar to many of those that you will have heard in recent years. And I think that's part of what we said about we can almost get numb to these. We can hear so many experiences like this that it starts to get scarily normal to us. And we can't allow that to happen. We kind of have to reserve the right to be shocked. And that's a bit of behind the scenes for the listeners is I've heard a lot in my years, you know, you don't have roles like working through the Samaritans and, you know, find that you're a person that's easily shocked by what you hear of people's lives. And yet, you know, when people tell me about experiences, I think it's important to show an appropriate response. And sometimes that is me saying, that's horrible. I'm so sorry that happened to you. Because sometimes I can even get numb to it. And I can hear people describe something and I'm sort of like, ah, yes, that follows a pattern. Of course, that's what happened next in the story. You know, we've got to, as you would say, keep present with it.
Got to keep present with it. And one other thing that I think is important just before I know we go to interview that I wanted to raise over the last couple of years with some of the work that I've been doing really opened my mind up actually to the amount of domestic abuse within teenage relationships and young people. And I think it's another stigma that's attached to domestic abuse and a lot of the support lines that talk about refuge and help for women and children. And whilst that is absolutely important and is the biggest group that are out there that are victims of domestic violence that we see in terms of our statistics, there's a real rise in emotional and physical abuse for younger people that's not necessarily recognised. And there's a norm that's starting to appear about how different individuals are treated within their relationships in their young lives. And we don't always recognise that. And there is not a lot of research around that. So I just wanted to make that point that we should not forget actually that demographic.
Right, for sure. And in many ways, Izzy fits that as part of the concern that maybe we can get caught up in the resilience of the young. And, you know, but that doesn't mean this doesn't impact them and doesn't have huge effects. And one last thing I wanted to raise in terms of the Me Too movement, you know, we hear all these stories and we hear particular names. And the one I'm going to mention is Harvey Weinstein. It can feel like it's something limited. You know, there's this mentality that can come about that it doesn't affect many people, you know, that that's just a Hollywood thing. You know, Harvey Weinstein, it's very far away. It's an isolated case, but, you know, it's not isolated. And that's how the Me Too movement grew, because so many women saw their experiences replicated through others. And that's something that Izzy went through as well when she was coming out of the experience she'll talk about today, seeing how many women have had similar experiences, and not just women. Mm. And so with Harvey Weinstein specifically, to this day, it's now been over 80 women in the film industry alone who have made accusations against him.
Wow.
So even if that feels like a Hollywood film thing, it's so widespread. And to think that that doesn't exist in other areas in this country, it does. Prevalent in the comedy community that will come up today. There's been accusations coming out even during lockdown. And I'm confident that part of that is that those victims are not as worried about losing a gig over making an accusation as they normally would be.
Well, yeah, Bobby. I mean, one of the girls, I'm sorry, I can't reference her name, who has spoken out in UK gymnastics. Sport is a huge thing that's now being investigated. I think it first was investigated in 2016 in the US, and then this year there's been an absolute, you know, a huge investigation into it in UK gymnastics. But in the interview, the athlete said, I would give up my Olympic medal in order for this not to have happened to me. And just like you're saying with a comedian saying, you know, I'll lose a gig or whatever people, you know, people will do, or people having to go through to actually stand up. Like we know within Hollywood, like you might not get cast if you speak out. We're not going to cast you again for a film. And we're starting to, the Me Too movement is really supporting.
Yeah, it's that crazy mentality that that person is then somehow a risk. Yeah. You know, to cast them. not the perpetrator. You know, obviously they should be seen as a risk. Don't rehire them whilst they're under investigation.
Yeah.
But the victim of it are also seen as a risk to the production. And that's the scary thing. And that's why I wanted to mention the comedy community, that for a lot of people in that industry at the moment, you know, they feel more empowered to speak up because they would hope that things will die down by the time that they're back to gigging properly, that their name won't be so associated with these allegations, which were not at them, are allegations about other people that should affect other people's careers, if anyone's. We've talked about it before as maybe one potential positive, you know, back when we first started looking at the pandemic in our 12-week series, that domestic violence in particular, but abuse more broadly, is having a spotlight on it. We're all being reminded that this is a big issue, and it's been a big issue. It's not just about lockdown. We should take it seriously now and always. And so on that note, we'll get into the interview with Izzy Staden. You can't help but warm to her through it, and she shares with such honesty. You just can feel her integrity through how she overcame what is far too typical an occurrence of the patterns of abuse, the way it escalates. She really articulated very well. So we'll get into that in a moment. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out. As a nation, we are currently inside and online more than ever. So it's easy to wonder what data is being collected as you go. Plus, it's an understandable concern, as here in the UK, it's not just online stores and search engines that have a vested interest in tracking your behaviour, but also your internet service provider can see every site you visit, and are even required by law to keep data on your activity for the last year. With similar concerns, I started using a VPN service a few months ago, and I'm already noticing a difference, with less ads following me around the internet, for example. ExpressVPN is the app I've been using that works by rerouting and encrypting your internet connection through their secure servers, so your internet provider can't track your browsing. Best of all, it works on all my devices, so my tablet, my phone, laptop, all have this service running seamlessly in the background. And it anonymizes your location, so less websites automatically know where I'm based, which was always something I felt a bit weird about. You can join me in easily protecting your data online. Just go to expressvpn.com/DMH, which stands for Destigmatizing Mental Health, to get an extra 3 months free on your 1 year package. That's expressvpn.com/DMH. We really hope you'll support them as they support us, and we'd love to hear how you get on.
My name's Izzy Staden. I suffered with anorexia nervosa since about the age of 12 or 13. The first symptoms I had, I just slowly began becoming very aware of what I was eating and very scared of the prospect of gaining weight after going through puberty. I restricted my intake more and more, and I became very obsessed with weight, and it sort of just took over my whole life, and I wasn't really interested in anything else but losing weight and sort of giving into my illness.
Yeah. And at the time, did that feel logical to you, or were you aware that this was unusual and that you weren't maybe having the approach to food that people around you were?
I think from when I was really young, I was quite aware that my sort of view on weight and food wasn't normal. I wasn't as concerned with being healthy. I just knew I never wanted to gain too much weight. I remember having that sort of thing in my head from quite a young age, and I remember thinking that I would do anything to make sure that I didn't gain too much weight, which I think was, I mean, a control thing. But I was aware that it was definitely abnormal and that other people didn't do this.
As you realised this, I'm assuming more and more, was there an impulse to get support, or was it more something that made you feel like you were coping or comfortable in some way?
I really couldn't see how I would be able to live without it. It felt at the time very much a part of me rather than me having an illness. I think with anorexia in particular, it's an illness that the worse you get, the more worse you want to be. It's very hard to get out of the cycle once you're in it.
Yeah, I can definitely relate to that. And it's a condition that I have as well. And I think for me, I often talk about it as like a gamification, that you start setting yourself more and more targets, and there is no end goal with it.
Exactly. I mean, when I was in hospital, they told me there will always be someone thinner than you, and anorexia will give you any reason it can as to why you should lose another 2 pounds or whatever.
Right, because none of this is to say that it's actually good. It just, at the time, it feels like it's something that, in a weird way, you're kind of achieving at.
Yeah, and you're just sort of pushing the envelope just like a little bit more and a little bit more.
And were you aware at that point, was there a clear kind of area of your life or thing that you were struggling to overcome that you see as part of the cause?
I think it was a multitude of things. I think at the time, I just felt like I was destined to have it and that I couldn't pinpoint a reason why I was doing it. It just felt natural to me almost to do. Like, in hindsight, I think I can see a lot more reasons as to why I did it. But I think at the time, especially being younger as a teenager, I think it's very difficult to clear your head and sort out what's going on.
And I think that's one of the things that's so difficult about this condition, that so often it occurs at this transitional life stage where you're already starting to go through changes with your body in general. Maybe you're getting attention from other people and you're thinking about relationships in the future more.
Yeah, for sure. I think a lot of it is, not to say that it's caused by puberty, but I think a lot of it can be triggered by bodily change that happens as you go through puberty.
Mm-hmm.
I know a lot of girls with anorexia and boys, and I know that for a lot of them, they were scared of the responsibilities of adult life and they wanted to stay almost childlike. And by not eating enough, they sort of maintained a more childlike appearance.
Yeah, well, that's it, because change is scary for all of us, right? That's not something, unfortunately, you grow out of. But when it's something as intimate as puberty, then of course that can be scary. And I think that's a real issue that can be related to sex education as well, that historically it's been so narrow. And it's not even that long ago that it hardly existed at all. But there's also how much that changes your relationship with yourself, let alone anybody else. Although that is changing and we're part of the changes with educational reforms on that.
Yeah. And I think a lot of sexual education, even with the emotional side, they take it back to hormones a lot of the time. And I think sometimes medicalizing it too much can sort of take away from someone's experience. And I think just the whole process of getting older, I think you experience so much during your teenage years. And I think that's sort of not really given enough credit for how like difficult that can be.
And I think that happens a lot with teens where things are dismissed as hormones. Like if they're grumpy, it's like, oh, it's just their hormones. They can't be taken seriously in their struggle. And of course, it can be hormones and also they're struggling.
Exactly. I mean, when I was in several psychiatrists up until I was about 20, would always blame it. Any problem I had, it would always be, oh, but you're a teenager, you're going through puberty. And it was like, well, yeah, but the cause is sort of irrelevant if I'm still experiencing the symptoms.
Well, you need that human approach that we have to identify what you need, both in terms of the day-to-day support, but also what's underlying that. Where has this behaviour come from? Because it's not this isolated thing. And that's something that can be so misunderstood. And that horrible mentality of, well, just make them eat. As if that solves anything.
People really try to simplify the problem, even though it has the most deaths of any mental health condition. And yeah, people always try and simplify it with the just eat, it's fine, but it's not. It's like saying with someone with cancer, like, just stop having it.
Yeah, just be less ill is basically what they're saying to you. And it would be lovely if it was that easy. It's not. And you're right, it's the one with the highest mortality level. And yet that's something that I wasn't taught at school. You know, I was taught so many threats to my physical health. And actually, it turned out this was the one that would be the biggest threat.
Yeah.
And I know there was a lot of ups and downs during your recovery, as is common. It's very much an ongoing process that I can relate to in that way. In what way did relationships play into that?
Anorexia made a lot of my early relationships quite difficult because I couldn't do things that, like, in quotes, normal people do or without anorexia would do. For example, boys would take me out for meals, but I'd be too scared to go. So I'd just say no, because the prospect of eating, let alone eating at a restaurant, let alone eating in front of someone else, was just absolutely, like, terrifying to me. And then as I got older and matured a bit, well, there was one in particular that sort of used my eating disorder and the fact that I was mentally ill as a way to manipulate me and control me.
And do you think, looking back on that now, that was part of their intention, that you were targeted in some way?
I think there were many sort of dynamics in that relationship that caused a power imbalance. I was very mentally ill. I was a lot younger than him. And he would constantly pick up on things about that and try and turn it back on myself. And if I had a problem, it would be because I was mentally ill. And he'd sort of try and gaslight me and use my mental illness against me.
Yeah. And if people aren't familiar with the term gaslighting, that's where you're told untruths consistently enough that you then start questioning your reality and believing that you are indeed crazy. And that's a way that an abuser can undermine your sense of self and make you think that their view on everything is the only truth.
Yeah.
And how did you meet him originally?
So I met him originally when I was about 17. He would have been about 26. I was in Edinburgh for a comedy festival, and I was walking around Edinburgh in a onesie, walking my very small white fluffy dog. And he approached me and asked me to come to his show, which I did. And originally it was very friendly. And it wasn't until about a year and a half later that he made any real advances romantically on me.
And for context, as someone that goes to the Edinburgh Festival a lot, that is very much a part of the experience. You are approached on the street constantly with people flyering you. And so initially, you know, you were a customer, really. You were going along.
Yeah, exactly.
Perfectly innocently and normally. And so how did he reach out to you when he did?
He lived in Ireland and I lived in London. He messaged me on Instagram. It was sort of very friendly at first. So when I went to his show, I had my dog with me, and he actually brought my dog up on stage and everyone loved him. Oh. It was a big thing. He then started taking pictures with my dog after the show. And so I was like, oh, my dog has an Instagram if you want to follow it. And he found my Instagram from that and followed me.
Interesting. Okay. And so again, this can seem quite familiar, but within the realms of not being creepy yet. Did you get to know him more at that point?
I would say more acquaintances at that point. He'd like my stuff on Instagram. Like, that was about it. It was very, it wasn't that weird at first. Nothing came off as abnormal.
Mm-hmm.
When he reached out to me, it was probably about a year and a half later. And at first, it was still the sort of same friendly interaction. He just messaged me asking how I was doing. But then quite quickly and quite surprisingly, the conversation turned and it became a lot more like, I almost want to say aggressive in like a romantic sense. And it was very clear that he was trying to start some sort of romantic thing with me.
Wow. And so at the time, did you have interest in it at that point?
I was interested. I found the situation slightly odd, but he would always talk about how he has all these struggles with relationships and he is, you know, awkward and shy. So I dismissed a lot of it, that sort of persona of him, because he didn't come across as someone like the typical sort of boy that approaches girls quite aggressively or sexually. He came across a lot more as like a timid, shy character. And so I think that's sort of, we have a false sense of security to a degree. I thought it was strange compared to other interactions I've had with romantic relationships, but I wasn't thinking it was anything inappropriate.
Right. And I think one of the difficulties is so much of social media is still kind of unprecedented. I feel like even all these years in, I still remember when platforms like Instagram were new, but it still doesn't really feel like we entirely know how to use them and what the etiquette is. So the fact that he was interested and he wasn't making you uncomfortable at that point, I can see how you just were happy to go along with it. And also someone in that position, like a comedian, you might think, well, they've got a funny schedule, they travel around a lot, they might be a bit sporadic to be talking to.
Yeah, and at the time, I was actually so like, I can't believe he's paying me any attention. He's this like comedian that everyone seemed to really like and everyone always said how nice he was. And so at the time, I felt like almost quite special he was talking to me and that he was giving me any attention. I think there was just so much I could excuse, like, oh, well, you know, we're not talking in person, we're talking over text, so some things can get misconstrued. He is, you know, very busy. So I think a lot of it was quite easy to dismiss.
Yeah. And at the time, would you say that was very linked to your mental health struggles, the way that you were surprised, it sounds like, to get that kind of attention.
Absolutely. I've struggled a lot with self-esteem, especially at that point, actually, and was surprised that any male would pay me any attention in that way. Especially having anorexia, it can sort of cut out a lot of romantic relationships. It's quite an isolating illness. And I didn't have many friends then either. And so I think sort of any attention I was getting, I was sort of grabbing onto a bit more than I probably should have.
And do you think he was able to sort of sense this, or do you think it was also maybe content you were sharing on your social media? He saw you as someone he could manipulate or get a certain like level of response from?
He knew that I had mental health issues because I've always been fairly honest about it since I was about 15. But I think once talking to me, I think for him to see how vulnerable I actually was definitely accelerated his behaviour and definitely made me a much bigger target for him than I think I originally was.
Mm-hmm. And when did things progress then beyond Instagram?
So then he would send me a lot of unsolicited pictures of him doing inappropriate things. And I think because I was so much younger, I was like, oh, is this just what people do in relationships? Like, is this just like normal? I didn't know. I'd never been sent nude before. I'd never sent one. And he would constantly send them and constantly request them also. And I was very uncomfortable with the idea of it. And I sort of reluctantly went along with it. But eventually he said that he was coming to London for a gig. This was about 2 months after like talking on Instagram. And he said that he was coming to London for a gig and that we should just hang out. And I was like, okay, well, it'd be nice to see you. So I just thought it would be nice. And we sort of ended up going on, I don't know, but what's a date?
And even there, I just want to pause because that's something that is very common in abusive situations, that there is this vagueness, because then it's sort of left the onus on you to figure out what's going on. And then also it means there's limited accountability. So if you had then turned around and said, oh, you shouldn't treat someone like this on a date, he could then say, well, this isn't a date, we're just hanging out.
Exactly, 100%. And he really used vagueness to propel most of his sort of like abusive behaviour. So we went on a date, it was fine. And then the next day he came over to my house to hang out. As soon as he got there, he was like very expectant that he wanted to have sex with me. That was very much what he came in with the expectation of. And I think I felt very much pressured into doing it. But at the same time, I felt like I could have said no. So I went along with it. And I still didn't think that there was that much weird about the situation at this point, because there was a lot of vagueness around the situation, and because I hadn't said no at any point for him to then get angry, because I'd always said yes, we'd never had any conflict.
And did you get the impression there would have been conflict if you'd resisted?
Yeah, I think there would have been. I don't think he would have got like, I don't think he would have shouted at me and made a huge scene, but I think he probably would have stopped talking to me or would have stopped talking to me for a period of time. And I think he would have been very upset and like acted like I was wasting his time.
Right. And I think that's important to note, those kind of manipulative tactics, because so often when we think about abusive relationships, people's minds default to men hitting women. And of course, that is only one type of abuse, and there are so many. And actually, oftentimes, all the others that don't fit within that are the ones that are the hardest to deal with, because that's the stereotype. And it's easy for all of us, I think, to draw a line in the sand in our minds of, oh, if they did something like this, that would be it. I would walk out the door.
Yeah.
There would be no going back from that. But what that misses out is that, A, in physically abusive relationships, that's generally preceded by all kinds of other abuse that have disempowered you up to that point. So it's not as easy a situation as it seems as an outsider. But then also there are plenty of relationships that don't have certain physical elements, but actually what you're describing is very insidious as well. And he's able to manipulate you whilst also potentially framing himself as the victim.
Yes. And I think it also makes it a lot harder to leave or stand up for yourself in that situation, because he can say that it was all done in a very different way to what it was. And it's very hard to sort of argue that situation. And, you know, if I ever said like, oh, you know, I feel uncomfortable about this, he would say, oh, well, you're mentally ill. You're being harsh on me. I've had a really hard time. and you're not respecting that, like you're being over the top, needy, controlling. And so anything I'd say, he'd sort of flip it back on me, which then just stopped me saying anything.
Right. And it's such a sign of power imbalance that he can do something like that in such a calm and intentional way. And then if you react, like if you get upset, then he can frame you as the unreasonable one because he's being so calm and reasonable. Why are you crying?
Exactly. Yeah.
And was there then a kind of escalation as you spent more time together in terms of his behaviour?
Yeah, I think what he does after talking to other girls that he's also done this with, the first few times he meets you, he's a lot nicer and he acts very caring and he's very relationshipy. And I asked him if he was seeing anyone else and he said, no, like, I'm just seeing you. It's like, I completely believed him. So then he would go through periods of ignoring me for like weeks and weeks on end, and he'd come back and he'd have some terrible excuse but he would pretend that nothing had happened. He'd have the most ridiculous reasons. He once blamed it on his iron deficiency, but he hadn't messaged me in 2 weeks.
His iron deficiency. Wow.
I know, it was so strange.
I mean, you need to be hospitalized if it's that bad. I mean, let's be clear.
It was awful. And he would be very on and off, very weird. But then whenever he'd come back, he'd send me 2 messages and then he'd immediately start sending me really inappropriate videos and pictures. And if I didn't reciprocate, he would be back to ignoring me again.
Yeah, and that's a great way for him then to disempower you, because it reinforces that you're lucky to be talking to him. Because he's so busy and he's got all kinds of things going on with his iron. You know, the fact that he's paying some attention to you, you need to make the most of it and be polite and be how he wants you to be, really.
And he would do this thing where he would talk about a friend and he would say to me, oh, I've got this friend, and they keep getting so annoyed that I don't reply to them. But you're so great because you never mind if I don't reply to you. And it was sort of like a way of him telling me what he wanted me to do or what I had to do, so he'd keep talking to me.
Wow. And probably playing you off against the other women as well.
Exactly. Because that was actually about my now best friend who he was talking about.
Wow.
So, yeah, very weird to figure out that was who he meant.
Yeah, but was there a reluctance in terms of actually committing to a proper relationship and like being Instagram official and that kind of thing?
Yeah, 100%. He obviously couldn't post much on his social media because he was seeing so many other women at the same time. It would be an instant giveaway. But he would act very relationshipy. But then if you ever questioned him about it, it would be so vague. He'd sort of say yes and no at the same time that he wanted to commit to you. He'd be like, you know, I care about you. I don't want to see anyone else. You're great. It's just, I'm so damaged that I couldn't possibly commit to anyone. And he played this very pathetic character that you sort of almost felt sorry for. He previously accused another comedian of sexually abusing him, which he used to excuse a lot of his behaviour. And I know from other girls who were victims of sexual abuse as well, sexual assault, he would use that as a way to try and relate to them and make them feel sorry for him.
Yeah, it's crazy. And we mentioned that off air, that it's like when people are chronic cheats and they then accuse their partners of cheating all the time. It's that same,
exactly,
like deflection technique.
Yeah.
And then how could you be as horrible as to think they cheat when they've been such a victim of it?
Yeah, exactly. And he would do that with everything. Everything had an excuse or a sob story after it. He would pick women that suffered from mental health issues so he could use mental health issues as an excuse. He said that he had an eating disorder. He said that he had different things to everyone, really. You know, if someone had depression, he would say, oh, well, I have depression, and you know how difficult that is, and that's why I've not been replying to you, because I just feel so bad. And because it's a personal experience, you're sort of like, oh, like, I do feel bad for you because I can understand it. He went after very empathetic women for that reason.
And oftentimes there is that real clear link between experiencing mental ill health and then having empathy for others in the same position. Of course you would. And then in terms of consent in the relationship, you were getting these kind of messages. It sounds like you sort of got used to, and maybe to an extent given up trying to resist the sexual messages.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, if you ever tried to say no, he would take your no as a joke and he'd be like, oh no, you do want to see this, and he'd send more and more. Like, almost, I think saying no sometimes almost like turned him on, and he would send more and more graphic things. And eventually, I actually got a boyfriend a while after. And when I got a boyfriend, like, that was the most of amount of attention I've ever got from him, because I think he was, I don't know if he was jealous that I had a boyfriend, but he would send tons of really inappropriate messages to me. And he would, I know he asked the girls to send him videos of them having sex with boyfriends. He would send videos of him having sex with other people to girls.
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, like, this is the wrong thing to say, but just the admin on this alone is baffling to me.
He would have, like, about 10 girls on the go at once. And he honestly needs to write, like, a time management book, because I have no idea how he did it. Like, he was having full... He would be Skyping with someone, watching a film over Skype, while texting four different girls. It was a constant thing. I don't know how he had the time for it.
Yeah, but it sounds like that had become the thing he was living off. You know, that was his ego, and probably, I would suspect, his way to not confront his own issues, because he's so busy distracting himself with all these other people, and maybe to a degree because he was targeting people with mental ill health. He was able to pretend these are the people that are struggling, not me. I'm fine. It's all them.
Yeah, that's actually an interesting point. No one's ever brought that up before, but I think that's definitely something he was probably doing.
Yeah. We talked a bit about consent in terms of images. Was that then an increasing problem in terms of seeing him in person?
Yes. So he would do things during... Specifically during sex, he would do things that he had no permission, that he hadn't gained prior permission to do. And he's done that to several other women that he's had sex with. Eventually, it all got to the point that he would start doing things to women that they hadn't consented to.
And do you mind giving me an example? It doesn't have to be one relating to you, but the kind of behaviour.
So during sex, he would choke people without permission. He would perform sexual acts on them without permission. I don't want to go into too much detail.
Yeah, sure.
To respect other people's privacy, but he would do very invasive things that I don't think any person would want done to them. And then in terms of sort of online behaviour, it would be videos of him performing sexual acts on himself, on other people, any sort of graphic thing you could imagine he would be doing.
Wow. You know, it all sounds like someone that was... very self-involved and had almost made that his art form in a really fucked up way, that comedy was supposedly his creative outlet, and yet he'd got so involved in this abusive behaviour that now it was almost like he was running his own porn channel by the sounds of it.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I think it was almost his purpose in life. He thought this was the main thing in his life, very, very clearly. And so during the time of the Edinburgh Festival was when he would see most of the females, because a lot of them were from abroad, but they would come over for the Edinburgh Festival. And he would be having sex with three or four girls a day, different girls, none of them knowing about each other, which is just like insane to think about.
Just baffling, that kind of behaviour. You can hardly believe that it goes on unless you hear it firsthand.
Exactly. I mean, because if someone had told me this about him and knowing him prior, I probably would have believed it, but I wouldn't have ever pictured him that way. Because you think of abusive people as being quite like physically intimidating, scary, very confrontational. He was a shy character that was probably an act, but he used that act to manipulate women.
It's a level of evil that is very difficult to even contemplate, really. And I'm so sorry that happened to you. When did things begin to change?
So I sort of had on and off contact with him for a while. I had a boyfriend, which I stopped speaking to him completely and blocked him on everything. After we broke up earlier this year in sort of April time, March-ish, I blocked a bunch of people, and he messaged me, and he actually apologised if he ever made me feel uncomfortable. And I was like, oh, maybe he's changed. And then he immediately...
If being the curious word there, that he's obviously not acknowledging it if he's still saying if.
Exactly. Yeah, he couldn't name a specific thing he'd done. He just said, sorry if I'd ever, you know, in any general way made you feel uncomfortable. That could be anything. It was once again being very vague. And he then started sending me loads of graphic images of him once again, and I was like, okay, you haven't changed, have you? Then in about June, his Instagram And I actually hadn't got like a weird, I hadn't got a picture of him masturbating for a few days, which was why I was like, I wonder what happened to him. And so I went and I went and Googled his name because I thought he might have blocked me for some weird reason. And it came up on Twitter that he was apologising for, it was a terrible apology. It was completely self-indulgent. He was apologising for something. Then I looked up tweets about him and it turned out that two women had come forward and expressed that they had been victims of his abuse. And this led to a wave of other women coming forward, all with really similar stories to mine. And we actually ended up forming a group to discuss his behaviour, which was a really, really helpful thing to do. And I think it's the thing that made me get completely over him. I think especially as I have quite bad self-esteem, hearing him do these things to me, I thought, oh, well, it's probably my fault somehow. Even though I knew it wasn't and I knew his behaviour was wrong, there was still something in the back of my head saying, oh, but, you know, you're a horrible person, so it's okay. But then actually...
Yeah, and also he was helping you with that, with the gaslighting. He was setting up that thought process and using your mental health issues to scapegoat his abusive behaviour.
100%. And hearing that he'd done this to these women who, like, I loved, and I was like, no, like, he is just a horrible, horrible man. And the fact that we all had similar stories was really validating, because sometimes you think, oh, maybe he would have helped with this. You know, oh, maybe I overreacted to that. Maybe that wasn't as bad as I thought. I'm probably just too sensitive, but knowing all these women felt the same was just money therapy can't buy.
Therapy money can't buy.
Therapy money can't buy, yeah.
In going through that experience and realising you're not on your own, that he'd done this to so many people and that it wasn't your fault, did you then find there was a turning point for your mental health there as well?
100%. Because the things he did to me made me think that my mental health had gotten way worse. Because I was getting upset with these things he was doing, and he was saying, you know, this is just your mental health issues, you're getting really ill, you're overreacting. And so I was like, oh my God, I have a crazy attachment issues and all this stuff. And when I realised I didn't, he was just being really abusive to me. You know, it made me feel a lot better on myself, and that I felt like things were more under control because I was actually right in how I was feeling, and they weren't, you know, spiralling out of control as how he was making things out to be.
And also, in a way, you were, it's horrible to even phrase it like this, but a kind of prime target for him in the ways that you were struggling, and also with what you later learnt was borderline personality disorder, because that's a condition where those that are dealing with it often rely a lot more on external support with their emotions, that their emotions are a lot harder to control and understand. Often that comes with a lot of checking behaviour of, oh, have I upset you? Because you can't always sort of accurately tell how you're coming across. And that's something that can be so easily manipulated.
Exactly. And also with borderline personality disorder, so much of the illness revolves around a huge fear of rejection and abandonment. And even if you don't even if you're not that fond of the person, you will do so much to avoid that rejection and abandonment. And he picked women with these specific issues because he knew he could do more to them without them retaliating or leaving him.
And that's the scary thing about situations like this, and particularly, as we know, with the Me Too movement and including the comedy side of that, there can be such common patterns like this, that abusers are so intentional and so, I mean, evil is the word I would use, in the way that they abuse their power. So... It's sadly not a surprise that when you spoke to other women, you were able to see such a template of his behaviour, that it was something that he got to work once, and then he was almost fine-tuning it through abusing others.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, I mean, he wasn't a hugely famous comedian, but he was well-known, specifically in Ireland where he lived. And because of that, he could use that power. And I think there's a thing within... many people within Instagram influencers, YouTubers, there can be this unbalanced power dynamic that makes it easier for them to almost groom people in a weird way. And I think that's something that sort of maybe needs to be thought about more, or maybe there should be some sort of legislation to sort of
It's really difficult. I know something that the comedy community is working on at the moment is creating a union, because in other areas like acting, particularly in America, there are really strong unions. There's progress being made there, whereas comedians, it's a world of freelancers. It does become really difficult. It's understandable that a lot of people could fall into that.
Yeah, and I think the idea of having a union is a really good one, especially as just communication between victims is quite a big thing. Because if it had just been me, I never would have told anyone else about this situation. I would have been petrified. But the fact that I knew so many other people had similar stories and were coming forward sort of made me empowered enough to do it myself.
Yeah, it's one of those things that, as horrific as it is to hear about how prevalent these experiences can be, we have to, because that's one of the key ways to take the power out of them.
Yeah, exactly.
We have to understand that you're not alone and that there is support and a camaraderie that can come with getting that support. And of course, the next step from all of that is justice. We are working as a society towards it, and that's good to see, but there is a long way to go. In terms of where you are now, you've ended up with an incredibly creative career yourself. And so in many ways, you are not only the one with the power in owning your story, but you are the one with the power of your own career and your own life and a boyfriend that seems great.
I really, really enjoy what I do. And I think it's definitely feeling in control of what I'm doing has definitely helped with the whole situation and getting over everything that sort of happened to me. I really enjoy what I do, and I think that makes it a lot easier. I don't think I would do very well on like a 9-to-5 normal job.
Yeah. And do you find that the kind of control you have in your career and your ability to have a creative outlet then has helped with your mental health and not relying on unhealthy coping mechanisms?
Absolutely. I never found in therapy they would give lots of advice on how to stop specifically self-harm. And so they would be like, grab ice, hit yourself with a rubber band, draw on yourself in pen. And some of these things really work well for others, but I just never found it helpful. But actually, if I have a surge of emotion, going and writing a song about it, sort of like almost like as cringy as it sounds, really, really helps. And it just like gets it out of me. And I feel 1,000 times better.
I don't think that's cringy. I think that's really lovely. But we're used to it in terms of people being recommended that they go journal, for example. I'm no good at music, love to consume it, don't understand how it's made. But, you know, I can see that that can be so transformative because music has such power to change how you're feeling. And when I trained as a Samaritans volunteer, that was something we were told to recommend a lot. You know, is there a particular song you like to listen to that makes you feel better?
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah.
And now you're the other side of that because you're putting out music that not only is fun and empowering and great to listen to, but it also relates to a lot of your experiences. So the new track is Lying to Yourself, which is A, very catchy, but B, very relatable, including to myself. I've met a lot of people who are lying to themselves and saw certain people in your music and your honesty in it.
Yeah, I mean, I always try to either related to my personal experience or related to people very, very close to me, because then I feel it gives more of an authentic feeling. And I think it is more relatable because you're actually talking about how you felt about a situation. And so I always try and do that with all of my music.
Yeah, I think that's really important. And we're reminded of that time and time again with the podcast, that people relate to what is real and what is honest. We want to see ourselves in other people and know that we're not alone in our experiences. And you've managed to turn that into a whole incredible musical brand for yourself, which is great.
Yeah, thank you.
And is there anything else you want to promote now that we're wrapping up?
I mean, if you want to see me mostly talk to my dog, you can follow me on Instagram. Might be a feature of how weird I am, is that I'm just completely obsessed with my dog. And she's a therapy dog, so I feel like it's somehow related to mental health.
Yeah, you're working when you're spending time with her. That's what it is.
Exactly. I think, like, because I used to take her to hospitals and see patients there. But I think since lockdown, she's like, had to work from home with me and sort of had to give me a little therapy.
Oh, that's so adorable. And she is very cute. So even just to see an adorable dog, definitely people should check out your Instagram. What's your handle on there?
It's Izzy_Staden, S-T-A-D-E-N.
Brilliant. All right, we'll wrap up there then. Thank you so much for joining us and for sharing your experience.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.